Virginia Satir is wasn't part of that particular group, but the people who were, Don Jackson and that, have been very influential for Satir, and she has done work with them. Her main book, Conjoint Family Therapy, which deals with communication patterns and roles in relationships, is in its third edition now. This book, People Making, is very much out of the systems background.
And that's in both bookstore and library.
Yes, and this is paperback. I brought along books that are pretty common. Jay Haley is part of that group. This book isn't as common, but it's titled, deals with this differentiation process. Leaving Home, The Therapy of Disturbed Young People. And you can just hear in the title the family systems background that he's working out of.
That's true.
Jay Haley. Carl Whitaker is one of those sages, gurus in family counseling. If Carl comes to town to present a seminar or something, you know that it's going to be about $200 a ticket to get in, sort of stuff. The Intensive Experience of Family Therapy. Easy reading. You can read that in a day easily and get a real good glimpse of it. A paperback book which blends a little bit of the transactional analysis stuff, because it's a psychiatrist that authored it, but it blends a little of that and yet does it with family systems as the dominant background, is Cutting Loose, An Adult Guide to Coming to Term with Your Parents. Hmm. You know, you can hear it. Differentiation is the agenda. Paperback, real accessible, inexpensive, $3.95, and I think far better than many others.
What is the person's name? Howard M. Halpern, Halpern, PhD.
E. Manzel Patterson has this volume in a series that Fortress puts out. It is, what's the series entitled? Let's see. Creative Pastoral Care and Counseling Series. Howard Kleinbell is the editor of the series. This one is Pastor and Parish, A Systems Approach. So the whole business of system theory applied specifically to the setting of the parish. The parish is a system of systems, and the parish pastor is a shepherd of the systems. Is the presentation of that book. A real handy little book for getting into systems theory. Greg?
Does transactional analysis have any influence on family systems therapy?
Well, Halpern, you know, talks about, uses some of those terms a little bit, but you know, transactional analysis looks at transactions, and so it's looking at relationships, and relationships are made up of two people. So in that sense, it does go beyond the Freudian thing of looking at an individual per se. But he really doesn't take the bigger step into the whole system, you know, that fully. I think that's just part of the evolving stuff over the last few decades that moves from individual to environmental influences. This book has really been very influential in my work with premarital people in doing premarital pastoral work, relationship work. These two folks who are Mormons and teaching at Brigham Young University, where there's a lot of stuff on families, have picked up the family systems material and used that, and they unpack it very carefully and clearly, dealing with relationships and dealing with it in premarital setting. They combine that with Taylor Johnson temperament analysis profile, and I use that as well as the Myers-Briggs, because both of them have implications for relationships. Okay, so a little bit there for some bibliography. Lots of other books, obviously. See, Robert Beavers has written a book about psychology and growth or something, but it's family systems, and he takes the stuff that on sibling order and says, well, okay, it may be true that the oldest youngster in a sibling group tends to take initiative and be responsible, and the youngest one tends to be a care receiver, a spoiled brat. And that may be the norm statistically in our culture, but that's not how it should be. It should be that older children not only give care, but can receive care. And for many of them, that's very problematic because their whole identity is caregiving. And so it's hard for them to receive care. And Beavers is saying, well, the oldest, the middle, the youngest, they all need to share in responsibility, to share in caregiving, to share in care receiving. That's healthy. So he's making something else a norm other than the way we see it, culture.
I just, for clarification,
right.
About in terms of positions of children, is it true that if the child is several years behind the other siblings that they take on characteristics?
Right, yeah. You know, a lot of things to look at, and what we have time for is really a admittedly introductory view, a simplistic view. Say you have a sibling group of seven, but between number four and three there's a gap of 5 years or more. Well, then the oldest of the lower set takes on the characteristics of an older child, even though in the whole system, the whole family, they're not the oldest child. But it's a new sibling group, right? And again, whether you're talking about male or female, in the mother-father male-female role models and what that depicts is going to be slanted by, well, mother and dad are which one in their sibling lineup. And you can, the whole business of sibling order is interesting. You get two children who are each the youngest in their sibling group, and they marry each other. And it's very chaotic. Because nobody is used to being responsible and in charge and taking care of. Giving care. They're used to being taken care of. So you have two little kids who are husband and wife, and it gets to be very chaotic. You get the two oldest to marry each other, and it's a constant struggle over, you know, each wanting to be in charge. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, it tends to be complementary because that's the way we are. Beavers, who says oldest, middle, and youngest need to be caregivers and receivers, those kind of people who marry, it would be more mutual. But we don't know how to be mutual yet. And you can read about it in a book. But if you grew up in this family, how you view yourself and how you interact with other people is going to be shaped by these experiences, not by what you read in a book. One to illustrate that, for example, in Pennsylvania, I worked with Volunteers Against Abuse Center in Zillionople, Butler County, serviced the whole county. We had shelter homes, safe homes, and would transport. Typically, you know, a lady calls up and it's an abusive situation, and we would transport her to a safe home, and typically she, after being there 2 or 3 days, you know what she does?
Goes back.
She goes back to the abusive home. And it's not until maybe the third time out that she starts to really consider not going back. Well, isn't it stupid that she went back? A lot of people would look at it and say, well, maybe it is. If we look at it and say, but there are all these other options. Why doesn't she choose one of those options? And the answer is very simple. They're not real options for her. Because she doesn't know how to do it. Mm-hmm. You sat me on that piano bench and put Beethoven music there, and there's a keyboard, and this piano's all in tune, and you say, play it. It can be played. It's a real option. I'll look for middle C somewhere. It's between this end of the keyboard and that end of the keyboard. It's not an option for me. Mm-hmm. I didn't have that training. I didn't have that experience. She didn't have experience and training and know how to function in other kinds of environments, and that's the kind, why she's in the kind of environment she's in. So it's easy to look at a situation for somebody else and say, that's an option. Why don't you, you dumb head, you know, why don't you do it this way? And really stupid, you keep doing it that way. But if you're doing it the only way you know how to do it, and you really don't know how to do it any other way, hey, you're doing the best you can. That's not being a dumb head. Yeah, there's a...
sibling yeah. Breaking order.
Yeah, birth order rules all, or chapter 7 devotes a few paragraphs. You know, to that. Any sequence. They've got male-female combinations and where you are, and, you know, it can, we could spend, you know, a week just on that. Yeah, lots of interesting stuff in there. Let's see. Somewhere I had some...
Does it matter how traditional your family is? I mean, I guess it does to some degree, but would it throw off your personality, if your family is super patriarchal, and
would it, I mean, throw it off?
Well, it's all colored differently, I guess. It all blends in. But I mean, I don't know. I see sometimes the oldest child in my family was a girl, but yet it was like expecting more of me to go to school than her. And to do some things that are to be taken care of, you know, by women, and and to be the head of the household, and my word's the final word, you know. Like last night, it was like something coming out of me when with Ilana and I were. She said, "Don't put the log on the fire." And I came back. I was a bit tired, and I didn't, you know, I put the log on the fire. She had to take it off. It was just mere bullheadedness, but. It really wasn't a conscious decision. This log was going on there, you know.
Yeah.
And regardless,
female does not have the last word.
Right.
In that family. In
right,
your family.
Right.
Yeah.
You know. And
you broke a rule. Mom.
You broke one of the rules. That's right.
He also noticed. He also noticed.
I didn't just say. Don't sit there and
say
because there was a fire underneath it before, and there's something about a hole.
Right.
So I put it on there anyway, and I took it off.
Well, they didn't sleep by each other, you know that.
It was so funny, because I didn't know you said
that.
You mean
they
would
have,
anyway.
Yeah.
Carolyn.
Right, and Lisa said, too, about the... Ilana told me that the fire was going to... the log was going to fall off, and sure enough, you know, after it burnt down a while, it fell off and almost hit Ron in the foot. But yet, but just because Ilana, you know, not because Ilana, I'm not picking on Ilana, just because it came from a female, it was like less.
Less legitimate.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's not fair, you know, but that's the way it was brought. My, listen, I say, sister, be quiet, you know, this is the way it's going to be, and dad would verify it, you know, or whatever. You know.
Do John or Ron, do you think we respond differently, or?
I think it would have, yeah.
I don't think so. You were going on a roll last night with that player.
It was.
He didn't tell you anything.
That's right. I was obsessed to a degree.
You were going to be a professional stoker if you could live a long time ago.
That's right. That's what my job would have been.
Well, when they announced we didn't have to stop the other day, he says, just when you learn.
But just for the sake of the tape.
Yeah.
Made a beautiful
fire. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank
you. That's what he wanted to get around.
But that made it even more my role.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, I'm cooking marshmallows for us. You know, it's really funny. I noticed something about my role last night, too, and thinking about the patterns and the rules and the things like that. And the whole way home, I was just angry with myself. I was so mad at least, and John heard me scream because I didn't want to cook last night and bring a pan, and I didn't eat the macaroni and cheese, so who carried the damn pan home? And I was so mad at myself.
I offered to take
it. But for the sake of, you know, not having someone else have to take it, I took the pan. And my ankle was bad, and the thing kept flopping back and forth, and the back and forth, and off. And it had about this much
Well,
and then I would, you know, I was right.
Before
so
Kevin left, I offered to right. take it too, and he said, "Well, you can take the little pen if you want to."
She's from Minnesota. You got to ask her three times.
Three times. That's just my pattern.
Well, I'm from Iowa. I offer once.
But really, yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's good because it demonstrates that just about any situation mm-hmm. is an opportunity to learn something about myself mm-hmm. and how I interact with people. And what it does is to, you know, John, after we started the break, John and I had a little discussion which highlighted that the roles, and mm-hmm. I guess it's in this book, Family Ties, the role that I accept in the family is not simply a role the family assigned to me, but there is something about my mannerisms and my caricature and my predispositions and so on that I accept that role. That is, there's an interaction going on between the individual and the family. You can't blame the family or point to them, you know? Mm-hmm. So what is it about me that that role really does fit with me and I feel comfortable in that role and I accept that role? You know, who am I that way? And it's a dialogical process between the individual and the family, interaction.
There must have been some benefits for doing that, you know, at the time.
Some benefits?
Yeah.
Somehow. Oh, sure.
Even if the negative ones. I mean.
Well, because I was thinking, because kind of being the peacemaker, which I kind of find my problem, the youngest by 8 years, and long story. But it's kind of, because it was really, it was wonderful to be kind of the caretaker and the nurturer, and that was a really good thing to be in our family, but...
Mm-hmm.
But to a point where I would jump in and do that with people when it wasn't good for me to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and trying to find a balance in that. Or,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's an example. So it must have worked for a while. Maybe in some ways it still does.
It works for the family and it works for the individual, and I think a lot of what it works means for the individual is I have an identity, I am somebody, mm-hmm. and this is what I'm valued for, and I keep doing it. Mm-hmm. You know, may not be how you really want it, but when you finally unpack it and articulate it, I think that's pretty well what it boils down to. This is my identity and I accept it, and now I know who I am. I wondered who I was. Now I know what I'm valuable for. And this is how I function. And my family accepted me for it, and you should too. You know, because that's my identity. And how did you get it? You know, to talk about it this way makes it sound simple. We have two daughters, and Leah's the older. And I noticed that when Melissa, the younger one, was you know, a couple years old and wearing a coat, then Leah, who's like 2.5 years older, would help Melissa with her coat to put it on. So when I say the older one is a caregiver, I don't mean that Leah washed clothes for Melissa and cooked for her and did big stuff. It's the little things. Yet so incidentally, you don't even notice it.
Mm-hmm.
But whenever Leah was there and whenever Melissa was putting her coat on, Leah is a helper. And she helps and she gives. And it gets, every time that's done, it's etched in a little more deeply, my identity is as a caregiver. Mm-hmm. Without being conscious of it, you know, without using those labels, it's just, this is my role, you know, I just do it, unreflectively.
Bob, I imagine, I'm sure you notice this too, but it's interesting since you mentioned that, Melissa has the role of being accepting the care there. And
oh,
so
sure
even
does.
In the situation with Jenny, where she's the older, she still accepts it. I mean, Jenny's the dominant one in that relationship. And so
yeah.
She still accepts it from Jenny, even though the age difference.
Sometimes it's interesting for those two to work together, because one morning, mm-hmm. Melissa, who very reticent to do things alone and to go someplace alone or to be alone, came down for breakfast by herself, and Jenny wasn't here. And so Melissa went on up the hill into Edward's chalet and got Jenny out of bed and got her dressed, told her to get dressed, and brought her down here, and they had breakfast together. You know, you know, so it's fun to watch the two of them, because they're both the youngest in a group.
Uh-huh. She's expressed that she doesn't want to lose her friend by not.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That, yeah, they're good for each other. Okay, so let's see. What? let's work on this list a little bit. And I wrote patterns up here. I want to talk about patterns first. Because when I meet with a couple, I will have one sheet of paper that just has a straight line across here, and it's the history of their relationship, and it starts with a big dot over here, and that's the first time they spent significant time together. After that one gets a whole lot of stuff written on it, and we kind of run out of time, I have another sheet of paper with two lines, and each line is for one of them, and the two lines come together over here where they first spent significant time together, and it's again a history line. It goes back to early high school. And I ask about, well, what did you do in high school? What kind of social activities? What kind of dating patterns? What kind of work patterns? What's it been like since high school? And looking for stuff that gets repeated. So you were married to this person, or you live with that person, or you were dating for 7 months with this one and 9 months with that one. And well, who was that person in their sibling lineup? You know, what kind of person is that? Oh, so you always go out with the oldest boy in the group. I wonder what that means. I don't know what it means. But you look for patterns. Look for things that get repeated. And you look for it through the generations. In ordinary people, Beth was at her parents' house. They were in Ellie's kitchen. And Beth said something about Con seeing a psychiatrist. And Ellie said, I thought we were done with that. I thought we were finished with that. And Beth said something about, no, it's still going on. And her remark was, well, you are firm with him, aren't you? And you could hear immediately how Beth was raised in this family and what kind of a role Ellie had in terms of strong, controlling role, which gets carried over to here. You know, and on. You can see the patterns of how things were here and how she, what Beth brings with her into this relationship. And this family over here, let's say, would represent the enmeshed side. When she left, she went back home. When they saw relatives, they saw her relatives. Mm-hmm. When we found out something about Cal or Beth's families, we found out about Beth's families. This was close. This was enmeshed. This was distant. So distant, we didn't even find anything out about them. Mm-hmm. And Cal was a distant sort of figure. Mm-hmm. And his conversation with Con, I mean, he at least talked with Con, but it wasn't you and me. Mm-hmm. It was, well, how's school? How's swimming? We'll get you into this college or... You know, which is a really distant, not an intimate sort of thing. They were, in this system, they had a good relationship, but it was a distant one, and Cal was a distant figure. And I think if we had heard anything about his family at all, I suspect we'd have heard about his mother. And I suspect she would have been a pretty strong figure.
She is mentioned in the book.
Okay. See, I haven't read the...
Yeah, he was...
Saw parts of the book.
He was raised in...
Okay, she, distance.
Was he? Was right. She was on web. Was that? She was coming soon. Yeah. I can't remember who his father was, but he didn't really have a father, and she had given him to be raised at a children's home or an orphanage. So that's all you know about him.
So he doesn't. She has trouble being intimate. So does he. You know, being close and showing caring is difficult here. It was difficult here. He would be a little more verbal, but to be intimate was not his thing either. Well, you see those patterns, and then you see what's being wrestled with down here. And like with the illustration of the Busey family, doing things differently than I know how is exceedingly difficult. I mean, how can I do something I don't know how to do it?
Cal was not intimate. Now, when we start talking about intimate, see what we really... talking about there, being able to show one's feelings and emotions to each other, because I think he did that in a couple places in the movie. One in the garage, getting out of the car, and one crying with his wife, or he went downstairs to cry, which shows some distance too. But he went downstairs and she came in and he was just questioning, you know, their relationship and the whole ball of wax. I think, is that intimacy? To me, that's intimacy, being able to show one's feelings and being able to cry. And,
well, yeah, I'm going to deal with the topic here. I want to lead up to it, John.
Okay.
I think, you know, what I would tend to say is he was breaking down under crisis at that point. Being freely intimate and choosing when to be intimate, he wasn't choosing when. He was reacting or responding to a situation of crisis that he could no longer cope, and he broke down. And that's not what I would consider intimacy.
He's also seen
that is the one place where the movie elaborated on the book, too.
Yeah, okay.
I didn't read the book.
Yeah, but the whole thing, some of it, is
Confessions.
Okay, a little bit here with my cue card shopping list. Marriage. When I meet with a couple, whether it's marriage counseling or premarital relationship work, what I'll do is to ask him, well, you know, what's the notion of marriage in the family you grew up in? Do you know why your parents got married? I mean, what are some typical reasons why people get married?
Sex.
Okay, they marry to have sanctioned sex. Pardon?
Companionship.
Okay.
Avoid the draft.
Okay.
Okay,
money. Yeah, it's supposed to be a joke. She goes and marries a rich man, but he goes and looks for a rich wife too, maybe.
I think we could say family cultural expectations.
Yes. Okay. Anna?
The giving and the sharing and the other person's growth.
Okay, related to companionship. Yeah, a sharing partner. Someone with whom to grow, someone with whom to journey.
Convenience.
Okay.
I guess it could be any sort of different things, but you need a wife for, I guess, cultural expectations.
Okay.
But also for, like, roles and different chores to do. Men grow something in the passive, you know, grow up to expect that they want a wife who cook for them and that type thing, you know, take care of the house
take
and the children.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Convenience or role expectation. I've known it where this gal up here got pregnant and left home and got married.
Mm-hmm.
And then her daughter gets pregnant and so leaves home and gets married. And her daughter gets pregnant, and so leaves home and gets married. The reason they got married was because she got pregnant, and the reason she got pregnant was that was the only way to get out of home. You know, going to school was not an option. Getting a job was not an option. Leaving home was a need, and it was the only way to, so to speak, legitimate it, or that was the sanctioned process. You get yourself pregnant, or I mean you get yourself, it takes two. Then you get pregnant, and that forces the issue of getting married, and hence you manage to leave home. Well, let's see, what do we say? You're pregnant, leave home. Some people marry for travel,
travel.
For adventure.
That's what I do.
Yeah.
Well, that's my idea.
You know.
Get married for travel. That's only one good reason.
It wouldn't happen in this group. But the person who married, the gal who marries the military, the fellow in the military, you know, to travel and see the world, that's not as typical, it's not at all typical with this group, it is with some people. Some people get married because they're afraid of being alone. It's a form of security. I don't, you know, if I picture myself at 67 and without a companion, you know, I'm afraid I'm so alone and I want to.
Do you think that's a big one, Lana?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a big one. People don't feel whole on their own, so they try to meet someone and connect with someone that makes them feel whole. So to me, that's kind of lonely if you don't feel whole.
But another thing he was bringing up about this. Some people think they want to get married and have kids so they're not lonely. That's kind of it.
Yeah. Okay, but the idea is to find out, well, what are the attitudes about marriage, and what are the expectations that she brings with her, and what are the attitudes and expectations here? So what was it in this family, what was it in this family, and are they talking the same thing, you know? Or is one expecting to get married to somebody who will provide financial security, and the other person is getting married to have somebody take care of the house, you know, raise the kids, but whether or not we have any money remains to be seen. You know, and it just, they're not talking the same business. Marriage, children, how many children to have, what's the spacing between children, when do you start having children, who's responsible for birth control, are you going to have any children or not have children? The whole business. What are the attitudes and expectations that this one person brings with them? What is it over there? Have they talked about it? Mm-hmm. You know, or do they simply bring unquestioned their own expectations and expect that the other person is going to agree? I mean, everybody in our family had the same opinion, so doesn't everybody in the world have that same notion? But you wouldn't say it that way because that's too obviously erroneous, but we enact it that way. Mm-hmm. Because we don't know how to do it else, you know, some other way. Discipline, how do you do it? Do you spank, do you don't spank, are you lenient, do you do it by holding a carrot out in front? Who's responsible for discipline? You know, the whole business, again, well, what was it like in this family and what was it over there? Religious backgrounds, religious affiliation, denomination, what does involved mean? Does it mean every Sunday at church, or does it mean twice a month or twice a year? Does it mean not only going Sunday morning but also committee involvement? When somebody says being involved in the church, they left an awful lot unsaid. You know, really, what does involvement mean? And what are her expectations and what are his? You know, you notice any conflicts over that in people's lives, in relationships?
What?
Money, who earns it, who budgets it, who spends it, who's responsible for balancing the checkbook. If in his family, his mother always did it, and in her family, her father always did it, who's going to do it in their family? And the key thing is, how are they going to decide? And if they don't sit down and talk about it, if they don't sit down and work it out, then it's a real source of ongoing conflict. Every time the check, the bank statement comes, you know, that stuff is, that agitation goes at it again. And what is work? Is work a source of income? Or is work a source of identity? Or is work a source of self-expression and liberation? You know, again, the whole business of attitudes and expectations associated with, well, what is work? Is work something you put up with until Friday, and then you go do what you really want to do? Or is work really the source of identity, the pride and joy, and a 72-hour work week is minimal? You know, and so what? Alcohol.
That was a big one about work, the idea of work. I see that a lot in my friends who are married, and that even when they have the same feelings about money, spending their money, the idea of working. If someone feels a need to quit their job and do something that's more enriching and uses their skills in a different way, and that puts them in a financial bind or something, that's really a problem.
Yeah. I think any of these can be major problems.
I'm thinking of women entering the workforce now, not just you know, to do the supplemental volunteer kind of things or something that where they really feel like, and I think that's becoming among women my age anyway.
And men are expecting you to work too. You know? That's something that you get married, you think, well, there'll be two incomes coming in now. You know? Mm-hmm.
When I saw that, I thought about the work in the house, or who should both work, or who should be with the kids.
Yeah, the roles and the rules that have to do with maintaining the house.
Mm-hmm. sharing a job is good.
Yeah,
you know, that's an
alternative.
Each work,
yeah.
20 hours.
My experience is that, you know, Jane talked about companion, and Arm talked about a companion to grow with, to share with, as a view of marriage. And as more women are in the workforce and as they are working for equal pay, as our culture makes those shifts and those changes, I find it very problematic in marriage relationships because we don't have role models to follow. Mm-hmm. We've got an idea in our head of what would be nice, companionship. But mom and dad weren't that way, hence I'm like the lady in the abusive family, or like Baker sitting at the piano bench with Beethoven music. I have an idea, and I have heard it before, and I know I've heard people play it, and I know people like it, but I still don't know how to do it myself, to be in a relationship that is what our culture is evolving. We strive for it, we yearn for it, we desire it, we seek it, at least we say so. But how to enact it, how to do it, we don't have the training for it, and it's very difficult, and there's a lot of potholes and a lot of rough edges, and it tends to be very abrasive, but people who stick with it sometimes get there. Yeah, I think that's the hard part, is not having a precedent that helps us do it easily. It takes a tremendous amount of effort. I have to be very intentional about it. Lots of energy. Alcohol, drugs, use, non-use, attitudes about it, the role it has played in the family. Has some one person been the alcoholic and that way been the scapegoat? You know, and what are the family attitudes associated? And so what does this person bring with them and what does the other person bring with them? And so if you have somebody who grows up in a conservative religious community where alcohol is taboo and they marry a German for whom beer is water, and you know, they set up housekeeping and she discovers a case of beer in the refrigerator, what happens then? Some real different cultural collisions and family patterns happen. Feelings. What kinds of feelings can be expressed and who expresses them? What kind of feelings are taboo that you may not express in the family? Who initiates expressions to whom? And, you know, when is it appropriate and what's appropriate? And how is it in one family and how is it in the other family? Conflict. How is it handled? I got acquainted with one couple. This ties in with, they had been married like 2 weeks. And the gal came in and she, you know, just crushed and in tears and distraught and thinks the marriage is ending and they're going to get divorced and how come, and it's because he yelled at her. Well, he came from a family that when there was some conflict or some disagreement, there was stomping of feet and waving of arms and yelling and swearing and screaming, and you know, it was very boisterous. And she came from a family where when there was some conflict, why, everybody just kind of moused up to their corner of the house and stayed there for a while, and when they cooled down, then they came back together. And she'd never heard anybody yell, rant and rave, stomped her feet and scream, and you know. And so when he did that, it was like, you know, being asked to play Beethoven and never even having heard Beethoven. I mean, just totally foreign. The only thing she could imagine is we're getting divorced. Well, they weren't getting divorced. He was just upset about something. Very different attitudes, experiences, and expectations. Affection is, I tend to think, one of the most volatile on the whole list. Because of our need to be cared for and affirmed. But what does affection mean? And how is a person cared for and affirmed in this family, and how is it over there? Well, it may be verbal, I love you. And if the family is always saying, I love you, on the one side, and on the other side it's non-verbal, that's a real setup for problems. Because the person who expects to hear the words, I love you, doesn't feel affirmed. Doesn't matter what the other person does. If they don't do it in the way that, let's say, Beth expected to be affirmed, she doesn't feel affirmed. And if she doesn't feel affirmed, then she feels neglected. The same would be with Cal. So it may be verbal, I love you. It may be tactile. It may be a pat on the back, a pat on the butt, a hug, some kind of a touch, a squeeze on the arm. It's, you know, it's done in gesture and nonverbal. It may be something small, like I just mentioned, or it can be something a little larger, a card, a bud vase with a flower, a meal, some item. Gotten for, retrieved for, or whatever, a small item. Or it can be something major. The making of clothes, a major thing. Or woodwork. Or adding something onto the house, a room. It can be something considerably large. So one couple that I got acquainted with had been married to each other and they got divorced. And then they got married to each other again. And they were on the verge of divorce. And her complaint was, well, he doesn't care for me. You know, he doesn't love me. Well, how do you know? Well, he doesn't say it. And you ask him, well, what's the problem is? Well, you know, she doesn't care about me and she doesn't care about what I do for her. She doesn't accept what I do for her. So both of them felt they weren't cared for. Her family was very much an I love you family, always saying it. I love you, I love you, I love you. And it's all the time, I love you. Everything was punctuated with I love you. It's the opposite of Vienna's family. And his family, and people do things for each other. Well, this fellow, what he had just done was to rebuild the kitchen. Did marvelous cabinet work. Rebuilt the whole kitchen, and she didn't feel cared for and affirmed. You see, but with every tap of the hammer, he was saying in his language of affection, I love you. But she couldn't hear that because it wasn't auditory in the sense of those words. Well, you know, the problem or the task is to learn each other's language of affection. And even though it may be as foreign as playing Bach or Beethoven, you know, to try to learn it and practice it and be able to traffic in each other's language of affection. And I really think that's maybe the most vulnerable one on the list. Well, violence, you know, is there a history of violence in one side or the other? And not just talking about conflict, but explicitly. Have you ever hit her? Have you ever hit him? Have you ever been hit? Have you ever been hit? What are the patterns there? What's it set up for? Well, so on and so forth. Sexuality, a whole lot more than just sex, is what does it mean to be male and what does it mean to be female in that family and in that family over there? And what does that say about your self-identity and your relating to the other person?
Yeah. I feel like I have to do it. But
that's all right. I don't know either, but you can do it.
Even if there's the violence isn't in either of the families, if someone feels like that person had potential for violence, even if there's no reason for it, if they're just frightened. I've heard some of that from some of my stuff that I've done
with
people, and my husband said, I would never ever hit you. But the wife said, I always feel like when you're angry or when we argue,
yeah.
I mean, I'm scared to death of you. I think you're going to hit me. And he's just totally hurt and offended that she would think that he had any kind of violence, that kind of violence.
Yeah.
And she just feels really frightened. So that's, even though there isn't, you know, that's a good thing to think about.
Well, it may be that that he never would, and even the idea would never occur to him. But if she came out of one of the quiet families, then her perception of his behavior is that it's very violent and it's very frightening and it's very unpredictable because it's unknown. And if it's unpredictable, then I am anxious. So from her side of it, we're not saying, well, he really is an abusive person, but the idea is, well, does she perceive it that way? And what is it about her that she perceives it that way? What is it about him that she perceives it that way? It's relational. Both people are in on that perception. Not just his behavior, but she as a perceiver at that point. Mm-hmm. And to unpack it as a dynamic in the relationship.
And I would guess it could be the other way too, where there really is that possibility of violence that the person has been able to keep within and could never admit and so on, but that she perceives that it could.
Yeah.
All these cases you hear of, you never dreamed that person would ever do that.
Or the child who grows up as an abused child and swears they'll never be an abusive parent or spouse, but again, not knowing how else to handle conflict, you know, when push comes to shove, they go into automatic gear, and automatic gear is what's been etched in deeply. And we do it as a knee-jerk reflex. We don't think about it. We just do it. Pow! You know, when push comes to shove, that's what happens. Good. Yeah, there's a lot of it. Recreation. Greg?
I'd like to touch on sexuality a bit more.
Yeah, okay.
All you mentioned was that brings in a lot more than sex and role
yeah.
models.
Mm-hmm.
I guess from personal experience, I know a couple that recently got divorced because they had different expectations of their intimate sexual relations. Is that something that is that a volatile thing? It seems to be affection and sexuality, or at least sexual, intimate sexual relations, aren't they tied in very closely? Or would you separate them?
Oh, yeah, I managed to link it all together. Yeah. You want to hear my little lecture about sex? I have some little canned lectures. There are many sermons that I wind up giving. It's an occupational hazard. They may last more than 3 minutes. I have one about children. Especially when people say, well, we're going to wait to have children for a few years till we have enough money. Mm-hmm. You know, and my immediate question is, well, now, what informs that? And if it's the cultural attitude that my two-year-old has to have designer jeans, mm-hmm. and my three-year-old has to be a ballerina taking piano lessons and gymnastic routine weekly, and, you know, that's expensive, but who says that is what is what it means to have children, the only way to have children. So I do engage some people's value statements, and especially if I think it's a culturally informed value that's not intrinsic to family. I have a little sermonette like that that deals with the anatomy, physiology of intercourse, and it's a polemic against Hollywood that says climax is where it's at. And we have to do it together, and then we're united melodically with the harmony of the universe and all this kind of, you know, garbage. Mm-hmm. I have a slight interest in massage. I have an interest in relationships, and I really think that all the stuff that leads up to it, which gets called foreplay, it can be play and can be fun and can be enhancing relationship. And the stuff that follows afterwards can be enhancing relationship. And climax is probably the most selfish time, in a sense. It's the most self-centered time. Physiologically, what happens in terms of muscle tightening and blood congestion and muscle release is just about the same thing as happens when you sneeze. Now, when you're sneezing, do you answer the phone? or do you answer the door? You know, I can't make any assumptions about your sexual experience, but I'll assume you've all had, you know, you've sneezed. So how much are you paying attention or caring or interested in somebody else in the midst of a sneeze? Well, you're not, you know. All you're aware of is self.
What's that?
Never sneezed.
Every time I was sneezing through the session, Lisa says, bless you.
Now I told him he must really feel good.
Yeah.
That's what you think about God when you sneeze.
Thank you, guys.
Are you, that's right.
Well, my point is that what is done to enhance the other person, to enhance the relationship, is whether you're talking about sex or recreation or money or anything on the list. It's like somebody comes in for marriage counseling and they're there by themselves, and you know, I can say, well, you know, you and I can work through what we can work through, but this isn't marriage counseling. It's certainly not relationship work, because the relationship's not in the room. You know, I have your perception of it, but I don't have the relationship. Until both people are in the room, the relationship's not there, and trying to do relationship work tends to be about as effective as doing surgery on somebody when their body isn't on the surgery table. Mm-hmm. You know, if the relationship isn't there, I don't see it, I don't have my perception of it, you know, pretty hard. Okay, so all of this stuff, everything on the list, the whole approach to it, in terms of premarital stuff, but I do the same thing when people are married and having marital problems, is this whole business of systems is getting at the relationship. If the relationship is stuck somewhere, where is it stuck? Why is it stuck? What are the attitudes and expectations that are locked in some rigid way, that and there's no flexibility left, and the rules are not known, and hence they're not modifiable, and hence the relationship stuck. Well, let's see, recreation, you know, any family patterns of recreation. I have trouble having fun. Certainly I have trouble having recreation. My family never did. In my memory, vacations were trips to North Dakota to visit relatives. And a couple months ago, I was home. My dad was talking about the same thing he's talked about for the last 40 years in my memory. Sure, it would be nice to have a vacation and go see the Grand Canyon. Like, take the family, go see the Grand Canyon. You know, a recreation vacation. But they were always relative vacations. He still talks about recreation vacation. So I never learned to play Beethoven, I really have learned well to simply have fun. Tend to be, you know, very serious and very heavy, and I don't really like that myself, and I look at some people who are very spontaneous and gleeful and think, gee, I wish I were a little like that. Mm-hmm. Not too much, though. Hobbies. What are the attitudes about hobbies? Hobbies are supposed to pay for themselves, don't you know?
That's right.
If you spend some money, somehow you've got to be able to get that money back, okay? But some people say, no, the hobby gets $20 a week and it's a drain hole. I never expect to see it back. I mean, I just write it off. It's going to cost me $20 a week. No questions asked. I mean, that's a hobby, you know? What are the attitudes about hobbies? They can be very different. Hobbies take up all our weekends in the winter. Or all our weekends in the summer, or hobbies come first, and you know, or hobbies get a couple hours once in a while, and that's all. I don't know. What are the patterns? What are the expectations? And they can certainly be conflicting.
Especially if sex is a hobby.
Sex is a hobby.
Yeah.
For some, you say.
Yeah, so, I mean that could really be conflicting. If sex is a hobby for someone rather than an expression.
So for one, it's a hobby, and the other person grew up in a puritanical home. It could be a problem.
Puritanical? Wow. Well, for someone, it's an expression of affection and that kind of thing rather than a hobby. But you don't have anything else to do.
I always thought hobbies you did by yourself, you know.
We're talking about specific types of sexual activities.
I'm talking about hobbies.
No, you were talking about things.
Like,
I don't know if that's, you know, I don't think I would call it a hobby. I think I would say that's part of somebody's image of what it means to be husband, what it means to be male. Not a traditional hobby as such. If you go to the hobby store, they probably wouldn't have
it. Oh, right, you have a job.
Oh no.
Great talks of the you know, the young cultures, Friday and Saturday evening, and that's all that they get money together for is dressing up right and going to the discotheque. And sex is definitely tied in with that.
Yeah,
and
it's part of the recreation.
That's a highlight of the week.
Right.
And that's what they spend all the money and all the spare time on.
Yeah.
I would say that I can see it's a patient too.
Okay.
That.
Yeah, some people can be a hobby, or it can be what I tend to call addictive behavior. Their whole life centers around it. Some couples take out loans, and they keep going to marriage retreats, you know, enrichment weekends. The marriage never changes, but they've been to more retreats around the country and spent time with more gurus than anybody. You know, it's kind of a status symbol. Well, how many have you been to? Oh, yeah, well, I've been over to that. I've been, you know, that's the thing they're into. Some people are into horses, and some are racing cars, and some are stamps, and some are, you know. You name any brew of beer in this country, and I've tasted it, and I can't show for it. And, you know, it's a. Yeah.
Well, I think of, you know, all the books that are written now, and all about all the little, you know, the creams and the lotions and the animal underwear. You know, I mean, if you're talking about hobbies, you can get all this stuff for hobbies,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
Sure.
That's good.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Hobbies, subcultures.
Well, Fritz said we need to develop a hobby before we get too much older.
And it sounds like a good one to you, huh?
Bringing up Fritz, one of the things I've been bothered with, and I brought it up when he was here, and I didn't push him very hard on him because I felt, I think I was going soft on an older person. But one of the things that really bothers about this, and it has to do with values of a relationship, is that he said most of the people can't expect their work to be fulfilling. And that's how it works. And then he said,
I agree.
So what we need to do is develop hobbies. That your work is just, he contends that there's just a small minority of people in the United States that their work can be an expressive part of their person.
Yeah.
Oh, I think so.
I agree.
Yeah.
I disagree.
Yeah, I worked in a counseling testing center at PLU, and people would come in, well, I don't know what to major in. Well, I don't know what kind of a job I want to get.
Mm-hmm.
And in our culture, where there are limits at what kind of jobs people can get. In mass numbers. And so something to look at is, all right, my employment may be a source of income and some satisfaction, but where I really express who I am is in what I write or what my hobby is or what I do in my free time. So that's part of it. Our avocation may not be our occupation. Another thing is that given an occupation, let's say a pastor or, I know that one best, but even teachers, teachers have a little more to go with. When the kids finish a confirmation class, they tend to disappear. Families move in and families move out. Pastors move. And so there isn't much concrete, tangible stuff that you can see as the end result. you know, did the years in confirmation really impact me? You get done with a worship service, and you get done with a sermon, and you get a few polites. That was a nice sermon, Pastor. But, you know, did anybody really hear what I was trying to say? Was the gospel heard in spite of what I said? You don't see that. And so, yes, at seminary, people have, you know, professors have been known to say, well, a good hobby for somebody with a job like that would be like woodworking or something where you do have a finished product. It is concrete and tangible, and you can have the feedback, the affirmation that I made that, and take some pride in it. Because you don't, teachers, you know, the kids go on, what becomes of them? There's a little concrete, tangible stuff in the scores, the grades, you know. The